Hello, I am Joel McLeod.
I'm Roland Tanna.
And welcome to a special edition 905 Roundup here on the podcast. It's been a while since we've done one of these things, but Roland and I have been wanting to follow up on two episodes that we did a while back because the topics are back in the news seemingly this week as well. We have a special guest returning as well, so this is kind of a bit of a throwback 905 Roundup. So topics that we're going to talk about today, folks, are we want to follow up on the episode that we did with the Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario President Karen Brown on essentially violence in our school system and how that has progressed or not progressed, as the case may be, as well as our episode with Natalie Mara of the Ontario Health Coalition to talk about healthcare in the healthcare status in our province. And our special guest to join in, folks, you may remember him from TikTok, social media, other places of note. But Frank Dominic, welcome back to the podcast. Always great to have your insight, and welcome to the show.
Glad to be here. I'm looking forward to complaining in a different venue.
Fantastic. Before we get into that, folks, we are just going to take a quick break to recognize the sponsor of this week's podcast.
This is Charles Adler. After a few years of working on radio and television, The Charles Adler Show has evolved to a natural place in 2023. YouTube, podcast, and open RSS. You'll hear the show as it always has been delivered, concise, with context, clarity, and empathy. And as a bonus, the guests will be natural-born storytellers who won't fear telling stories that are personal and emotional. They won't fear uncomfortable questions. Most important, they won't fear me. Follow me on Twitter at Charles Adler and subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, and we're back. So let's start off with education. Basically, I know that this has popped up again in the news. We have violence in the schools, violence from students against their teachers, and it's not just, you know, it's not the worst places, worst schools in Ontario. It kind of seems to be a bit across the board a bit. Frank, you're a teacher. Maybe you could give us an insight in terms of like what is it like in Ontario schools, particularly maybe in the 905?
So like, when people kind of think about education and stuff like that, it's so different across the province. But like in my classroom, so for example, if somebody was to say, have I ever experienced violence in my classroom? No. Have I ever experienced violent intent or the threat of violence in my classroom? Yeah, I've had students who have slammed doors and thrown things and stuff like that. And that's no different though, generally from what it was like when I was in elementary school. Like I, as a kid, had a couple of temper tantrums. I never hurt anybody, but I definitely once or twice threw a chair in my prepubescent and puberty years when I was still developing with my ADHD. I had a lot of social issues in that regard. So I think we have to keep in mind that there are incidents and there are scenarios where it's like, you know, it could be a kid who's going through something. We don't know what their home life is like. We don't know if there's a developmental issue there or social issue there. But like, for example, my wife last year, or 2 years ago actually, had a kid in grade two threaten her with a pair of scissors and say that he was going to attack her. And I can't even use the language that he used. A grade two, I can't even use the language that he used because I don't want you guys to have to bleep everything out.
We wouldn't anyway.
But you know what I mean, right? It's a scenario where like maybe you might get flagged on TikTok or on Facebook if the specific wording isn't there. So there are some kids who and we don't know where it comes from. You can say, oh, it comes from home, or maybe there's something wrong and the kid needs to get help. And there are ways of looking at that. But when we look at systemic violence, so for example, is it Tomkin Public School in Peel, as mm-hmm. well as York Memorial in Toronto. So if anybody remembers York Memorial earlier this year, just Google York Memorial violence, and you will see all the floods of articles from October and November. And whether it was weapons or fight clubs and all this kind of stuff. There was a lot going on there. And I knew some staff members there and I heard stories, plus the stories that you saw online. And when you consider the fact that this is stuff that normally we don't consider to be like the reality of Canada, this is like, oh, this must've been an American school. Right. And that was like when I did my stories on this, all the comms were like, oh my God, are you sure this wasn't a school in Texas? Or are you sure this wasn't a school in Florida? And that was coming from both Canadians and Americans. So everybody is in disbelief of the violence that we're facing in Ontario right now. And it's not like it's overt violence where it's like we're constantly dealing with weapons and stuff like that. But even small acts of violence add up because there is no reason why a child should have to witness violence in their classroom. And as I said, so I had developmental social issues growing up with ADHD and other issues. And yes, there are incidents where a kid who is trying their best and is going through some stuff can cause a ruckus in the classroom. But if it's ongoing, or if it gets to the point where children are being hurt, teachers are being hurt, EAs are being hurt, it goes beyond, oh, let's try to help this one individual, and into a territory of there is a pattern. So how do we identify what is causing this pattern and how do we solve it? And I don't have an answer for that because like it seems to just be out of control.
A theme that I've come across, well, actually, first of all, I just want to, you mentioned the Tomkin Middle School. And remember, this is middle school listeners, not a high school. So these are quite young children, you know, not the youngest, but middle school age. They're not 6 foot tall. They're not about to go out into the workforce. A letter, a sort of public letter, was put out yesterday by teachers from the Tompkin Middle School in Peel region. Can't read it all here, the letter's too long, but I mean, I could read out a couple of edited highlights here. It's become impossible to maintain any sense of dignity at our schools. Students will come up to your face and tell you to fuck off. Students will ignore any boundaries or structure remaining at schools. Students have shown time and again that they are willing to uphold any type of decency towards staff and students in buildings. Students have defecated on the floor of the bathrooms. They've run through the hallways, throwing water at each other. That seems like small fry compared with the other stuff. Vandalizing washrooms. And I know from conversations with other teachers that, you know, vandalizing washrooms, this kind of stuff, it's kind of fairly ubiquitous. It seems to be at our schools that you know, the bathrooms have the doors taken off because you can't let the children close the door because of what will happen if they do that.
There's degrees to the bathroom stuff. Like, just like, I was in high school in 2008 to 2011-ish. And before I had gotten to that high school, I was like, yo, why are there no mirrors in any of the bathrooms for the guys? And it's like, well, because people used to like pour lighter fluid on them and light the mirrors on fire or smash the mirrors. I never had mirrors in my bathroom for my entire high school career.
And to be fair, I mean, when I was at school back in, you know, the Stone Age, the boys' bathrooms were not a pleasant place to go either, even back then in the 80s. So it's not like bad behaviour has always existed, and it's a difficult area to monitor for obvious reasons. But, I mean, the list goes on and on about the stuff that's been done, and it does ring true from the conversations that I've had with other teachers, in the conversations we had in the run-up to our interview with the EFTO president Karen Brown, of kind of standards of discipline just being not just declining, which has probably been a constant and perennial complaint of teachers. It's like, children these days are so much worse than they used to be. And you can appreciate that, well, maybe that's just the way teachers always feel. But that there's something fundamentally different here, and that worse still, that they don't have, that the school administrations do not have their back in this. So the real complaint that grabs my attention in the Tompkins school complaint is that after all this behaviour of people threatening violence, of pulling X-Acto knives, of vandalising, etc., no one's been suspended. No one's been, you know, there have been no consequences other than restorative conversations with students and parents who are still willing to show up.
Can I highlight one of the things in terms of not getting suspended, just in terms of the sanity of that? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, threatening other kids with X-Acto knives. Another situation here, hitting somebody so hard with a meter stick that it knocked out one of their teeth.
I mean, it's like, these are reasons to call the police. These are physical assaults. This is breaking the law. There should be accountability for that. Restorative justice is not, has its, you know, I don't want to be knee-jerk against that kind of stuff. I understand the point of, you know, trying to make children understand why things should not happen. But at the same time, at some point, there needs to be a sort of hard line of like, you've crossed the line, you're in big trouble, this is what's going to happen now, you know? Does that sort of resonate with you, Frank?
No, so like, we're in this weird situation because like, so like for example, I hate it when people are like, you know, we don't fail kids anymore and they don't know consequences. Well, the kids who used to fail weren't the kids that, like, for example, when I was in high school, my average in grade 10 and 11 were in the 70s, and I should have been a high performing kid. I should have had 90s. And instead, I didn't try until grade 12, and then, okay, university matters. And then my average was like a 93, right? And that's what happens with a lot of teenage boys. They don't really try until grade 12, and then all of a sudden, phew, their marks skyrocket. And so when we talk about like, oh, we don't fail kids anymore. Well, it's not kids who need a kick in the butt like I needed, who are the ones who experience the consequences of failing. It's the kids who really struggle and we want to keep them in school. So when we talk about why don't we fail kids anymore? Well, because if we fail kids and we don't keep them on track to graduate, maybe they don't graduate, or maybe they spend more time out of school, they get involved in whether it's gangs or whether it's involved in other forms of crime, or even just not feeling a sense of community and not fully accomplishing their abilities. Failing a kid does not truly benefit anybody, because like when we talk about earning your high school credit, earning your degree, what they need to earn are the skills involved. And we can still get them those skills without them getting a 90. They don't need a 90. Getting them to the 50 for some kids is good enough. So, and I think if that's where it starts with in some people's minds, oh, schools are getting too soft. Okay. So that's the first thing in people's minds. And then the other thing we have in people's minds is, okay, we don't have dress codes anymore, so kids can do whatever they want. You want to get into the human rights conversation of that? That's a whole separate thing. But there is a dress code. It's just that we can't really tell somebody what to do with their body, because that's the world we live in. Even in Canada, depending on your job, there aren't dress codes for certain careers. Going even further than that, then we talk about, okay, well, so how about suspensions? There's no punishments. There's no consequences. And this is where we get to a tricky situation where we have these two main issues that I'm seeing. One is progressive discipline, which a lot of teachers and administrators don't understand what it really is. And it's that discipline is supposed to start with like, hey, let's talk it out, let's work on it. Then you move up to, all right, you're going to be punished, but the punishment is going to be one that is easy to deal with. It's going to be in school. We want to keep you as part of the community. It's kind of like a three strikes thing, but you know, you keep escalating. The problem is, well, if the kid's first incident is a violent act where they threaten a kid with an X-Acto knife or smack a kid with a meter stick, well, how do you have a conversation about that? It's not really appropriate to do progressive discipline when the first, I'm not saying this was the first incident, but the first incident could be something massive. And I've seen, I wish I could talk about some of the things that have happened in my school, but unfortunately, like, that's just not appropriate. But I have seen some things where kids who on their first offense do things that I would consider to be hate crimes. And there's not really, when you talk about progressive discipline, it's very, very hard to work within that framework. But on the other side of things, and I want to make this very clear, a lot of the kids who do stuff like this, their parents, it's not like, they learn it at home thing all the time. Sometimes, yes, but sometimes you get kids and you meet the parents and the parents are like, we don't talk like this at home. We don't engage with this type of stuff at home. We're a very open and welcome family. And so a lot of these kids, especially young males, it's coming from Joe Rogan. It's coming from Andrew Tate. It's coming from, and there's nothing wrong with, once again, consuming Joe Rogan content, but I'm talking just the general manosphere of
right.
These kids are engaging with.
Well,
and so yeah, the one thing I was just going to say, sorry. And then
go ahead.
It's just, there's no proper method with parents because you don't want to upset the parents because you don't want to deal with there being this big issue coming out of something small. But at the same time, like, some parents are demanding and craving punishment even for their own kids. And so what, we're going to pick and choose who gets to be dealt with in certain ways. Like, it's a very weird and robust, constantly changing, amorphous blob of punishment, and there's no real set in stone guidelines for it.
Well, I've always had a problem with the I find the argument that I keep seeing, and then the letter in question is actually up on Twitter. It's from a Twitter account called @TorontoTeacherX, and you're going through the replies to it, and you get where are the parents, and it's the parents have this sense of, or kids have this sense of entitlement, parents aren't disciplining enough, and I always find that argument to be bunk, because that argument has been around since schools were invented. Parents don't discipline their kids enough, and kids always have it too easy. There's that argument has always been there, so I don't buy that that's what's happening here. I think I think you touched upon a bigger factor, though, is that, when you get into the Joe Rogan and the Andrew Tates of the world, because the one thing I think is different in this current age that we're living in is social media, is the fact that every kid starting in middle school kind of has access to an iPhone or a smartphone, and is able to go down those rabbit holes that I think I would hope you and I and our listeners would kind of have a red flag and say, okay, you know what? This is bunk. I'm going to steer away from this. But when you're that young and impressionable and you're looking for answers, it's easy to kind of go down that rabbit hole. And I don't know how you combat that, because the other problem is parents, I don't think, are equipped themselves on how to address that. How do you address that kind of toxic masculinity?
Yeah. So
I also argue some parents also, I think, buy into it. I know for a fact as well that some of them buying into it and say, oh, these guys aren't so bad, and they don't take it seriously in its own respect.
I was really on the internet by the time I was about 10, grade 5. Mm-hmm. I had social media grade 7. Once again, it's kind of messed up to say, but I was really on the internet at a young age, back when the internet was more unregulated and more of a Wild West situation. And I saw messed up things as a kid, like not even sexually explicit content, but like ISIS beheading videos or whatever whatever was before them. All that kind of stuff. And I saw this stuff as a kid, because this was so easy. You can find it on Google, and people would just share links in a messenger chat. And you don't even know what you're watching until it's too late. So the internet's not like that. The internet is not like that anymore, where the kids who are on it are being exposed to all of this so instantly. But the truth is that stuff like that still exists. And so when we talk about what kind of content are kids consuming, the one thing that I just want to kind of make clear is that we don't know what kid is consuming what content. We don't know what kid is consuming what level of toxicity, because I think that if a lot of people saw what I consumed as a child, they would have think that I would have turned into some kind of degenerate adult with no moral guidings and no understanding of empathy. And I think that I have grown into an adult who is considerably different from the type of content that I consumed on the internet as a kid. The problem is that because it wasn't so popular back then, I could kind of just deal with it on my own and come into it on my own. But because everything is so shareable now, and because it's become more of a fad thing, oh, you don't watch Andrew Tate? Oh, well, you don't do this, you don't do that. Well, then all of a sudden, even if you don't agree with the content, you have to consume it. And you can't process it on your own, because you're part of a conversation. And so I think that there is even some peer-to-peer indoctrination outside of adults and outside of the content creators themselves.
I mean, I wonder to the extent to which, we say, well, I think, okay, so let's take as a fact that the behavior in school is worse than it used to be. And if we do accept that fact, it's like, okay, well, why is it? Is it because parents are worse, or is it? And when I was a kid, it was all about we're all going to be corrupted by. It sounds so naive now that it was going to be video games and 18 movies from Blockbuster that was going to corrupt society. And now it's like, oh, that's just that's not going to be your problem. And I wonder if it's not so much that. The things that children are dealing with have changed or are different. It's just that we are not implementing the basic kind of boundaries that previous generations had. Now, you mentioned you have ADHD. I had ADHD as well. And know, I am so happy to see that the sort of accommodations that happen now for say, you know, when I was a kid, kids with ADHD, I'm the more kind of dreamy, look out the window type of ADHD rather than hyperactive type. But for the kids who were hyperactive, who were always just branded as naughty, as troublemakers, as no hopers, you know, I'm so happy that that's not the case anymore. That there's, you know, the treatment, that the classrooms are willing and able to make accommodations and make learning better. But at the same time, even, you know, I sometimes see some of the things that are done for ADHD kids and think, I'm not sure that that would have actually helped me or any of my ADHD sort of compatriots. It's like giving extra time to do a test to someone with ADHD is like giving a heroin addict heroin, you know? It's like, don't give us extra time. That's the last thing you want to give us because we're just going to waste that.
Yeah, and so like I grew up right in the beginning of those types of accommodations. So like, mm-hmm. for example, at first I was told that my school board, your Catholic district school board, couldn't accommodate for me. I was violent outbursts, as I had mentioned earlier. But then they found out I was gifted. We're going to get you a laptop, one of the first laptops in the whole school board. We're going to send you to a new school, and it's not going to be a new school where they put violent kids. You're going to be in a school with other gifted kids, and we're going to give you this, and we're going to give you that. So magically, all of a sudden, because I scored a higher number on a test, I was treated better than all of the other kids, which I get why they wanted to do that for me, because they saw that I could succeed and they wanted to help me succeed. But, and back then it was the tech was so much more expensive, but we need to now make sure that we're giving every kid the chance to succeed. So like, for example, extra time, basically everybody with an IEP gets extra time. And so like I maybe once in a while used it when I was in high school and elementary school, it would mainly be if I dozed off during a test, if I was just staring off into space, I would use whatever time I'd spent staring off into space. I would try to not take an absorbent amount of time. And I find that a lot of kids who have IEPs are really good about that. They don't want to take an extra 30 minutes. They want to take an extra 5, 7, 10 minutes. They don't want to be seen as abusing the system. But it is difficult because you're like, yeah, like when we, so one of the ways I explain it to people, it's like when you're training for something, whether it's a marathon or climbing a mountain or running hurdles at the Olympics, you don't start by doing everything all at once. You start by doing one thing at a time, and then you tack on the next thing, and then you try a harder thing. So you try sprinting and jumping separately. And then when you're doing hurdles, you sprint and jump and sprint and jump until you get to the point where you can actually do the hurdles. The problem is that when we get rid of all of the difficulty and challenges, it's not that I hate using the term learned helplessness, but there is a small amount of that. And for many kids, it's not a problem because they don't want to use all those tools. But for some kids who just want to seek that shortcut, and I don't blame them because they don't have the fully adult brains to think through why it's important for them to learn these skills. They just see that shortcut and they go for it. And then in the long run, that hurts them. So we're in that, once again, that weird sticky place where like, so we just get rid of all accommodations for everybody? Well, no, that doesn't make sense. Okay, so do we lower the accommodations? Okay, so then what is the bar? Everything's amorphous. There is no set defined boundaries for anything. And that's what I keep going back to in my head. It's like, and there's almost no way to do it, right? It's tricky.
Yeah.
I was thinking like, you know, what can governments do then? You know, how do we change? How does the Ministry of Education change the parameters so that we can better help? I'm going to say help kids succeed, not discipline, because I think that's just a too low of a bar. I think, like, how do we ensure that these kids succeed at education, at getting the skills and tools that they need to succeed in life, rather than just, okay, how do we discipline them? Because necessarily the answer.
I think the solution is a lot easier than people think in terms of like, because we're thinking these grand plans, you know, target each kid individually. I don't think it's that. I think it's you cut the class sizes in elementary school in half, or maybe cut it down by 20%, 25%, and you increase, and you have to pay these people. We can't pay them minimum wage like we are. You increase the funding for the amount of EAs that we have, and every kid who needs an EA gets an EA from JK until the end of grade 3 to help them learn those skills. And then once again, like, it depends on what age they're at, we provide different accommodations. But the reason that I became so successful, or however you want to say that I came out, compared to where I could have been in grade one, where they wanted to remove me from my school and put me into a school for kids with anger management issues and social disabilities and stuff like that. From where I started to where I am now as an adult, I am only here because I was given every accommodation, whether it was the laptop program, being in the gifted program, having a school psychologist to talk to and all that kind of stuff. And I had a team behind me and it worked. I came out the other side in such a better situation than I could have ever dreamed. Even if my parents had put me in private school, I would not have gotten that quality of care. And we need to give that to every kid, but that means funding. And that's a lot of money.
But see, that's right. I'm hearing the naysayers listening to you, Frank, saying, you know, we're just going to accommodate these brats, these punk kids that are, knocking teeth out with meter sticks and what have you. We're gonna accommodate them. What are you, a soft snowflake?
I am a little pudgy. I'm a little sick.
But I mean, like, I'll be honest. Part of me does say, like, haven't we already accommodated so much to these kids already so far? Right. Is that kind of why we're in the problem that we are in now?
Because we talked about it before, before we started recording, let's talk about the Doug Ford comment, because sure. I feel like there was some validity to what he said, but
Doug Ford had something to say on this topic. Shocking.
Okay. So I want to frame it as saying, as a Doug Ford hater, I think that he started that statement the best that he could. And I think that he was trying to make a positive point in that, you know, there shouldn't be violence against teachers. Teachers have a tough job. Schools need to be safe for students and for teachers, and we need to find a way to solve this. And that was great. You know what, Doug, I appreciate that. And then he went into, well, you know, if I ever did something like that, I would have gotten home and gotten beat up by my parents. And it's like, yeah, except we shouldn't be hitting our kids. So maybe the premier should not be suggesting corporal punishment as a solution.
Yeah. I mean, it's the irony. I mean, and it's talk is cheap, isn't it? Because saying that kind of thing of this shouldn't happen is an easy thing for Doug Ford to say. And it plays to his base to say, oh, you know, back in my day, we just used to clout kids around the head and that was all fine. No one, you know. Plays to his base. But you're exactly right. How are we going to solve this? It's going to be money. And it does come down to class sizes. Because we all remember that class we had when we were, well, I certainly remember classes I had where my normal class size of about 30 was 15 for one reason or another. And all of a sudden you had this class where you saw so much more of the teacher, where the problem kid was not nearly as much of a problem because the teacher isn't trying to balance them with 30 other children and just spreading themselves too thin. With smaller class sizes, you do imagine that I think it's been proven time without number that smaller class sizes make discipline easier. Therefore, it's a better learning environment. Therefore, people learn better. Yeah. You know, it's a virtuous circle. You know.
Well, I can't say smaller class sizes. It's easier to intervene before the behavior becomes a problem. Yeah. And you see, if you know the kid in question is a problem child, for lack of a better term, when you kind of say, okay, I can see them going down that path, their head, you know, that their behaviors or their tics, that it's like a poker game, right? The teacher knows, okay, you have your tells, you're going to go and someone's going to set you off to be disruptive in the classroom. It's easier to either have an EA come in and say, okay, I'm going to head this one off before it becomes a problem, or the teacher's able to intervene and it doesn't disrupt the whole dynamic of the classroom when it happens.
And I think, so like, for example, one of my classes, I have 35 kids. And I love that class. They're great kids. And I'm bouncing around all the time because they all have questions. It's economics. There's a lot of like thought process that goes into it, but it's really hard in that 35 kid scenario to identify the one kid who, you know, is struggling and find a way to get them help. Like, and I don't think people consider how much time teachers spend during lunch and prep and before and after school on the phone and talking and emailing to other teachers, to the guidance counselors, to try to figure out like, hey, like I have this one kid and I taught him last year in grade 11. And a lot of people were like, new, like, yeah, he needs help. Like he's a good kid and he has so much ambition, but like, there's a lot going on there. And this year he has come so far, and he dropped out of my class in first semester because he was struggling, but he joined it in second semester, and he's doing so good right now. And he's going to graduate. He's going to get into the school that he wants to get into. And it feels so damn good to see that he is succeeding, but nobody sees the hundreds of hours of conversations between teachers and warning your next semester, like, hey, like, you have this kid, like, keep an eye on him. He's a great kid. But he struggles with this. And teachers talk, like, when we have a kid like that, whether it's a really, really strong kid or a weak kid or a good kid or a bad, whatever you want to frame it, whatever the kid's struggles are or successes are, there's a lot of times where you spend time at the beginning of each semester talking to a teacher. You're like, hey, like, I see you have this kid. Like, if you have any questions about him, let me know. Like, I've worked with the family before. And that attention gets kids to succeed, because I was a kid who succeeded that way, and I am helping kids succeed that way right now. But it's tough.
Does it play into kind of the mindset that we have as a society on education as kind of an input-output model? Of we put the kid in the classroom, the teacher stands at the front of the classroom and says, you know, recite your ABCs and do your math and you know, recite to me all these important dates from this textbook. And then I expect, you know, 18 years later, they walk out of a high school and they're supposed to be able to, you know, they go into the next phase, go into university, college, trade program, whatever the case may be. But it's a constantly this kind of like input output, whereas we don't take into account that some kids learn it a different way. Some kids learn more advanced, quicker than others. You put it in front of them, they pick it up. Or some kids, you know, it just takes them a little bit longer to process the information and the circumstances in front of them. And I'm just wondering, like, do we have this concept of education backwards, that we need to get away from this, you know, again, this input output mentality, and just allow kind of that mushy middle of, hey, you know, some kids are going to become great artists, some kids are going to become great scientists, and some kids might go on to become a great economist someday, and we just kind of have to let them find their own path. And the idea of you as a teacher is there to nurture and guide them and present them with the options available to them.
I think one of the tricky things there, because like once again, like there's only so much to go off of, but like I am a firm believer in at the same time that education is a way to prepare people to enter the workforce, because that is the nature of a capitalist economy. Let's not kid ourselves. It is a way to get kids to teach them how to socialize, to get them ready to, whether it's go to university or college or the trades or the workforce, it is a way to get them ready to be adults in the world. But at the same time, the goal of education, the true goal of education, and I hate sounding like a damn hippie, but education's about enlightenment. That's what but enlightenment doesn't mean finding nirvana. Enlightenment means learning about yourself. Like that student who I was talking about last semester, he learned about himself and he has become a better person, and he is going to hopefully do great things. He might collapse under the pressure of the real world, or he could do some really, really cool things. And I can be proud to say, like, hey, you know that like famous guy? Like, I taught him, and you would not believe what he was like when he was a kid. And I'm sure that I have teachers who, after seeing what I've been doing, they're like, oh, I taught Frank, and damn, he was annoying. But like, look at him now. He's being annoying and being famous for it or whatever.
Now he's annoying on a podcast.
but it's like, yeah. Simultaneously, school and education should be about skill building, should be about learning about yourself, and should be about preparing people for the workplace. The problem is that I think when we say it's only about the workplace and we don't focus on the skill building, we lose out on the real value of education. But if we were to do a skills first approach to education, the workplace stuff would come with that, because you need the skills to be valuable in the workplace. Mm-hmm. So we keep shooting at the goal, but we're missing the base. You got to build your tower from the bottom up, not from the top down. Like we know what the base is. The base is skills, fundamentals, working on a team, literacy skills and stuff like that. And when people say back to basics, and here's the other problem, Doug Ford's going to keep saying, we got to go back to basics with math, back to basics with reading and writing. That back to basics approach only works for 30% of people. And those 30% of people might become the doctors and the lawyers and the engineers, but it will fail the other 70%. We have systems that work. The discovery math curriculum that everybody hated, it was used when I was in elementary school and in high school. It works because all of my friends are engineers and doctors and lawyers. it worked, obviously, because we had some of the highest graduation rates at the time. And so we have to also be careful of saying, oh, we have to get back to basics. We have to go back to what matters. Yes. But we can't do that through rote memorization, and we can't do that through strict punishment of kids. Like, there are middle grounds here. And I think that's what my concern is when people talk about it, because people think it's one or the other. There is such a spectrum in there.
Yeah, I don't want to give the impression either that I'm some old school hard ass saying, you know, what we need is firm rules. Well, what I feel like I'm hearing from a lot of teachers is they want to teach exactly in the way that you just described, with exactly that level of passion, and with exactly, you know, it's like, that's why we got into this job, to change lives, to make people's lives better, to release the potential in children who may have gone off the rails, but for meeting me in my professional capacity. But we can't do that because the basic standards of behavior in my workplace are chaos. I'm dealing with feces on the walls, or I'm dealing with knives. I can't release someone's potential when just I can't even, you know, or, you know, say, let's say it's not as bad as that. I can't release someone's potential when what I'm basically being reduced to is a badly trained social worker dealing with society's problems rather than a teacher. It's like, I haven't been trained to be a social worker, but that's actually what I'm kind of doing here, day in, day out, rather than teaching my subject.
And so I'm glad you brought up the social worker point. If you have another point you can go with, but I just want to clarify something that's really important. When people talk about people working in the public sector, whether you're a teacher, a nurse, or a cop, we are, before anything else, social workers. That is what we end up having to do. And that is not the responsibility of a teacher or a nurse or a cop. We are not supposed to be social workers, which is why I think there's a lot of complaints and failures in those three careers. And it's very easy to point fingers, and I do. And I point them at myself and I point them back at others. But you're right. Like, that is what's happening in a lot of these public sector jobs, because we keep asking for more and more and more, and we give maybe more funding, more teachers, more cops, whatever, but that doesn't solve the problem. We need more social workers. We need more, a more robust mm-hmm. system.
You know what? Let's just take a quick minute, and then we'll be back with our quick second half for on healthcare. Okay. I think we have enough time just to cover, because we did promise our listeners we're going to touch on this for the latter half of the episode. If you go back to our episode on the Ontario Health Coalition with the president, Natalie Mera, she was talking about bringing in a referendum on healthcare in the province, which sounds all nice and warm and fuzzy, but when you really think about it, it's kind of a strange that a not-for-profit is the one kind of bringing in this, like, what's the status quo in healthcare in the province? And my understanding is that they're going to, it's basically a survey. You can go and fill it out and say, what's the status on healthcare in your particular part of the province? And at some point, they're going to release the findings, which I'm sure we'll report on when they finally do. But I do want to talk about the fact that Why is it that we have no easy access to data on the status of our healthcare system in this province? I know it's there, but it's a real pain in the neck to go searching. You're going through websites and you can find wait times and whatnot. But in terms of, like, just scorecards on the things that matter most to Ontarians, it's really hard to find if you're not going to go and actually maybe talk to the hospitals themselves.
One of the interesting things that I think is, I'm going to take a real hard pivot here, but I promise you I'm on topic. This is going to sound crazy.
All right.
One of the benefits that came out of COVID was that we learned that our government can move quickly, and our government can collect necessary data, and our government can actually be successful and do things and work together when it's needed. Why can't it be like that all the time? Because there is no data collection in Ontario or in Canada in general. And one of the strings that was attached to the healthcare funding from Trudeau was that we implement this data collection system across the provinces. And that is great because we need this metrics-based data to make sure that A, the provinces are spending the money where it needs to go, and B, that money is doing what we say it's going to do, and C, that we know how many doctors are seeing how many people at how many times, and all. Like, we need that data. Like, that is how we are in the age of AI, in the age of metrics. How are we not keeping that information? That is gold in the modern era.
Yeah. I mean, it's a problem. It's a problem I've noticed, you know, going from growing up in a different country and also contrasting how Canada contrasts with the States, where this attitude towards data is all data is open all the time, and it's one way. Whereas we take a sort of very secretive attitude to data in this country, where, you know, even during COVID, you know, it's like the data about where outbreaks were happening and why they were happening couldn't be shared because, as well, that's potentially personally identifiable. And, okay, there's good reasons for that. At the same time, we need to have the data and use it to properly develop our policies and to properly target our treatments. And it's also, I mean, it's, and we should mention that I'm just looking at Ontario Health Coalition's website right now. So their referendum, as they call it, is happening on May 26th, May the 27th, which is next weekend, next Friday and Saturday. And you can go to their website and find out about that. Problem is, the bill that they're having a referendum on, saying vote no to privatisation, passed already. The bill is done. It's now an act. And I actually saw a tweet today, I can't remember who it was from, but basically saying this has happened, it's the game is over, and actually blaming the media for not really covering it well enough. And I mean, that's an interesting point. I don't know. Joel, you and I have tried to cover the healthcare story for the last 6 months or so, and it was actually very difficult to get anybody to speak to us.
Well, I remember we contacted many, hospital groups. We've contacted many of them around the 905. And some were very, initially they said, yes, we'd love to come on. Fantastic. Let's try it. Let me go get some talking points. And all of a sudden, like within 24 hours, no, I've been told I'm not allowed to come on your podcast.
So here's something that might be interesting of note. Did you guys hear about what happened with the Toronto Star and Dr. Moore?
I did hear about that he, yeah. So Dr. Moore, they asked him to come on to do an interview and he said, yeah, sure. Let's do this thing. And then within like 24 or 48 hours, like very shortly afterwards,
they didn't cancel until an hour before the interview or something.
Right. Yeah. But the Toronto Star found out through, I believe it was a freedom of information request, mm-hmm. that basically at that time it was Minister Jones, who's Minister of Health. She basically, in her office, interfered and said, no, you're not doing it.
Because they didn't like the journalist.
Right. Which, I mean, I kind of would be flattered if we were that notorious within conservative circles.
But I think it does go to show that there is.
I mean, one of the subjects we've covered the most since we've been doing this podcast is education and schools, and it's probably because our audience seems to really appreciate it. I mean, notice it in the statistics, and the subject that we're both very interested in and passionate about. I'm just as passionate about healthcare, really, but we have struggled to find people who will speak, and that's a problem. And it is a problem that this massive change, where healthcare is being privatized, which seems, well, you know, we're not really having a fully fledged kind of conversation about that. I mean,
because it was never an election issue. Like Doug Ford, and this is conservatives in general, but Doug Ford's really good at this. Good. They run on no platform, mm-hmm. and then they tear up the green belt. They privatize healthcare. They start to, they've tried multiple times to privatize certain parts of education. They just failed each time. And one of them was because of COVID. Thank God. Mm-hmm. Once again, the success of COVID was stopping Lecce from privatizing part of education. But like that's what happens when you say there's no conversation. You're right. There is no conversation because the conservative playbook is let's run on nothing except for balancing the budget, which none of them have been able to do and tend to make deficits worse. And then they slash and burn, starve the beast.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to go back to something you said, Frank, that I thought was interesting. You know, the fact that data on healthcare is very secretive, or at the very least, very difficult to get, whereas it should be a standard. I think like all data revolving education, healthcare should be an easy one-stop website. Go download a spreadsheet and it's all your raw data is in there. But in the age of, you're right, we're heading into the age of AI, and right now it's great. Like I can type up some show notes pretty quickly. I can get some tweets generated really quickly to help on that. But when you start getting into being able to put in this raw data and say, extrapolate a plan forward to get to X result. You know, I want to reduce wait times at this hospital by 20%, right? And imagine you or I being able to put that into an AI program. Say, find me a path forward. I've got this budget. This is the data that I have now. Find me a way forward. I want to reduce wait times for hip and knee surgeries by 20%. And imagine an AI program was able to present a path forward where it wasn't a matter of cutting wages or staff. It's just not optimizing. Just optimizing and saying, hey, you know what? If we operate this 24/7, this department 24/7, and you hire somebody to operate this machine, da, 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 and we can reduce your wait times by 20%. And you or I or anybody could go online and find it. Like how revolutionary would that be to our healthcare system where we don't have to, or really any department in government, that it's, we could say it's right there. It's open access that anybody can take a look at this data and present a viable plan to solve this. And it doesn't have to be like just one person. It could be anyone on Ontario could say, hey, put in the data. Let's figure out a way to save us some money or reduce our wait times. Or can we start streamlining operations or maybe even predict future pandemics, so we're able to handle them a lot better than shutting down the province all the time. The data is there. Like the data is there. We can use it.
Yeah.
And I find it's frustrating that it's being withheld by people who could really use it in a more inventive way than the power brokers that already have it.
I think the fear should be more focused on the fact that AI will be revolutionary in healthcare. But it's going to be revolutionary in the hands of Google. It's going to be revolutionary mm-hmm. in the hands of these multinationals. And so will our healthcare continue to be public, but we utilize private partnerships, which can be good? Or do we say, oh, well, AI's made things just so damn efficient. Why have public healthcare? Why not privatize more and more and more? So like, for example, Google recently did some like weird protein thing where they were trying to, it might not be proteins, I might not be getting the details of it wrong, but they basically simulated what would have taken traditionally thousands of years and came up with like 20 million different protein combinations of something. I don't know the exact specifics. They also were able to develop, I don't know if it was called a microscalpel or something like that, but they were basically able to develop some new protein-based tool that will allow for more, I don't know if it's gene editing or bacterial editing, but like basically it will revolutionize healthcare. And this is just with modern AI, the highest level AI that's not going to be available to public, but this is the AI that will be used in healthcare, for hospitals, in medicine. And so, yeah, you're right. Like this is the future, and we are just letting it stay, which is fine. It can stay in the hands of the private entities that created. I'm not saying that they need to be sharing it with everybody, but I don't think that the people in power appreciate just how much everything is going to change. And I don't think they want that change to happen truly for the benefit of all citizens. They see dollar signs. Mm-hmm. That's what they see.
it's an interesting question. If you look at the kind of money that a corporation like Google or Amazon or Facebook or any of these guys has, compared with you know, even major national governments, corporations are bigger, and those corporations in particular are bigger. Government, to an extent, is being out-evolved. You know, we still obsess about government all the time. We still follow it in the news. We still talk about it on Twitter. We obsess about it. And yet, the real developments in our society that have changed our whole lives have, by and large, not come from government. They've come from, well, first, the education sector. If you want to talk about the internet, it was initially from you know, physicists at CERN, but also from the companies that have grown from that, from the Amazons and the Googles of this world, that are just innovating at a whole other level from everybody else, who can just take something like
that. Yeah, I push back on that slightly, though, just because, like, so for example, penicillin, like, I mean, that was made at U of T through funding from the government.
I'm not saying it's a good thing. In the last 20, 30 years, there's been a shift away from the government really being the primary or only ultimate kind of source of innovation in funding for education or whatever, to one or two big companies dominating things in a way. And Google can just say, okay, we want to, what area do we just want to completely take over today? Self-driving cars, sure, right, we'll throw a few billion at that. And have the ability to make change in a way that no government can even remotely comprehend. I'm not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing. It's more of it's something we maybe don't appreciate enough as a driving force in the way the world is moving. We still obsess about what Justin Trudeau's saying, or Poilievre, or Ford, or whoever. It's like, well, really? Are they the guys who are going to change our lives between now and the next 50 years?
Like, I always like to say, government can be frustrating. It can be a pain in the neck. It can be, there are times when you look back and you say, oh my God, why are they doing it this way? But at the end of the day, government is the one thing that every person in this country 18 years of age or older has a direct say in. You may not like it. You may not like who's governing, like who's behind the wheel at the moment, but you have a more direct say in what your government does than you do in what Google, Amazon, Apple, or any major corporation does.
And even if you own shares with PFOF and stuff like that, like half the time you don't even really get a vote.
Right. But I do get a vote every 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
For three governments, my municipal, provincial, and federal government. So to say government can't do anything, I definitely agree with your sentiment there, Roland, that the collective consciousness is, oh, government is just so useless. In reality, it can do amazing things. I this completely on a tangent, but I like the fact that it's government that is sending a Canadian to the moon. It's government. It's not Elon Musk and SpaceX. It's not Jeff Bezos and his dick rocket, whatever it's called. And it's definitely not Richard Branson and his space plane. It's government. It's good old fashioned government funding, government collaboration. I look forward to when that happens. But I also say, like, it wasn't private enterprise that did it. It's government that's doing it. Public tax dollars at work. So to say, oh, they're useless. No.
And actually, it wasn't so much that I wasn't implying that they're useless, as just that there are the extent to which major corporations have
resources.
Yeah, have resources and have kind of stolen a march on areas that previously would have been seen as government prerogatives is something we maybe just need to understand and appreciate more and be aware of, because they are private companies and they are looking at the dollar signs. Mm-hmm. At least, you know, I'm just thinking of my 30-year-old copy of Blade Runner here, and you know the guy's
which version?
Oh, the one with the unicorn, of course. You know, okay. Director's cut, or which director's cut? Anyway, now we're really getting off the subject, but you know that kind of you know, post-democratic, corporate-driven world that was envisioned, that kind of sci-fi movie, it's a little bit where we're heading, and we just need to be aware of it. I mean, it's yeah, just history happening as we watch it, and we need to say, well, you know, because we focus so much on government, and I like you, I think government has massive potential for good when it puts its mind to it. It's depressing how seldom it does put its mind to it. And we also need to be keep our eye on that other side of things, which is new, but which is, you know, has the potential to make the government of Ontario, say, look like a game of tiddlywinks compared with what, you know, Google can do in an afternoon.
Well, on that cheery note, maybe we bring this episode to a close.
Yeah. I've silenced everybody.
I would like to say that I do believe that we the future will be bright. It might take a while to get there, but I'm as much as I think that there's a lot of pain and suffering that will happen in a lot of different areas, I am a firm believer in that we're not going to hit a cyberpunk dystopia. Like I there's going to be growing pains, but I think that 200 years from now we will be closer to Star Trek than to Blade Runner.
I wholeheartedly agree with you.
Hundreds of years.
the one thing with Star Trek is its fans are actually making the world.
Yeah.
But I wholeheartedly agree with your sentiment there. I would say also, if you zoom out of history, and Roland, you should appreciate this, if you zoom out from the viewing of history far, far enough away, you see the incredible amount of progress that we as a human species has made. It hasn't been pretty, and it hasn't been clean, but I do think we are a progressive species. We try and find ways of getting along together. So I agree. We're the future is hopeful. We just have to make sure that it is so. So thanks everyone for listening. Frank, very much thank you for taking your time to come on and give us your 2 cents. And we'll see everyone talk to everyone on the next one. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
That's it for this episode of the 905er. Thank you for listening. As always, you can send us your feedback, thoughts, and concerns, or ideas for future episodes to our email, info@905er.ca. We'd love to hear from you. You can help us keep the 905er going by financially supporting us through Patreon as well as PayPal. Visit us at 905er.ca and click on the support tab. As well, links are in the show notes for your convenience. Lastly, you can find us on social media. Search for the_905er on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. So long for now. See you next time.
I'm Matt Kundel, host of the Sound Off Podcast, the show about podcast and broadcast. Since 2016, we've been speaking with amazing people who have populated your ears for decades. Legendary broadcasters, research wizards, talent experts, podcasters, voice talent, almost 400 stories, all for free. Subscribe or follow the Sound Off Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or at soundoffpodcast.com.